Lessons from the early church. Today we are visiting Lystra. Lystra, not Listerine. Lystra. The story goes that there was a visitor who was visiting the local zoo, and he happened to notice a zoo attendant who was quietly sobbing by himself on a nearby park bench. And being troubled by what he saw, the visitor asked another attendant why the man was crying. The second attendant explained that one of their beloved elephants had just died. The visitor was touched by this sad news and then asked, "I assume he must have been particularly fond of that elephant." And the reply came back, "No, that's not it at all. He's crying because he's the one that has to dig the grave." Have you ever had one of those days? You know the ones I'm talking about, where you go to work or you go to school or you go to your regular activities and something out of the ordinary and negative happens? Of course you have. We all have. We all have those days that seem, despite our best intentions, to go sideways. And most of the time we persevere, hoping that the next day we'll be back to normal and whatever crisis we faced will have been resolved. I wonder if you've noticed something about the Apostle Paul. And if you haven't noticed it yet, I encourage you to pay attention as we make our way through our journey through Acts. There's a surprising and rather disturbing trend in these stories. It seems that almost every time Paul shows up and starts to preach, a riot breaks out, along with a revival. This is kind of an odd thing, considering that most often when I preach to you, the reaction is only coffee and genial conversation. I never see a riot. I don't know how Paul stood it as he traveled around. Well, actually, I do. He persevered because Jesus was with him, and Ananias had told Paul that he would suffer when he spoke to him in Acts 9. In Acts 14, Paul and Barnabas are continuing on their first missionary journey. They enter the region of Lycaonia, and in particular, they go into a city or town of Lystra. The town of Lystra was inhabited by remnants of a small little group of people called the Anatolian tribe, who spoke their own dialect, and it was still spoken up to the 6th century AD, of all things. Although Roman rule was established in Lystra, Latin inscriptions found in that area suggest that the occupants of that town kept a lot of their own native customs. Anatolia is a region of modern Turkey today. Ancient Lystra is now just a mound. And so far, it's never been disturbed by archaeologists. It's located in the modern city of Latik, if you want to go see it. Now, we need to understand that Lystra is different from the two Antiochs and Damascus and Jerusalem, because Lystra was inhabited by the... Now we have to understand that Lystra is different from these other places because there was no Jewish presence in this city. The reason for this was likely because Lystra was primarily an agricultural center. It was not really known for business activities. It was clearly a tight-knit community due to its shared ethnic background, its distinct dialect. And outsiders were not particularly welcome. Maybe you know of places like that in Canada or around the world. Nor would Lystra be seen as a promising location to make a profit. So the inhabitants are entirely, we can't say 100%, but almost 100% Gentile. And as we will see, their religious affiliation was to Greek gods. This is significant because, as we saw before, Paul's strategy was to go into a city and immediately go to the synagogue in that city and there first preach the gospel message to Jewish people and to devout Gentile believers who were part of the synagogue. It was a very sound strategy because Paul could establish a really good base of believers in the synagogue due to the Jews' pre-existing biblical knowledge. Paul could go into the synagogue and he could quote scripture to make his argument that Jesus was the Messiah. In Lystra, he couldn't do that. So the question presented itself, how in the world does Paul get these people to listen to him? Well, God always provides an opportunity. It happens in the form of a man who was handicapped from birth at the city gate. A man who had never walked and probably was left on that street day after day after day as a beggar. Just as in Acts chapter 3 when Peter healed the man with a similar condition, Paul now heals the man by the power of God. And the man immediately jumps up and starts walking around. And everyone who knew this man in town knew he couldn't walk. And they asked the obvious question, well, how did that happen? The whole town is in a tizzy. Actually, the whole town drops whatever they were doing and they rush to Paul and Barnabas. And they've barely gotten inside the gates of the city. At first, Paul and Barnabas were pleased with the crowd's attention, but something is wrong, very wrong. Sure, Paul got their attention, but you know the expression lost in translation? Well, that's kind of what happened here. Paul had expected the people of Lystra to come in response to the healing and then be intent to listen to him as he shared the gospel of Jesus. But Paul and Barnabas had walked headfirst into local customs and the religion of the people. The townsfolk had witnessed a miracle they assumed out of their cultural background and their religion that Paul and Barnabas were two of their gods in human form. In Greek mythology, it was a common belief that gods took on human form and interacted with people. Quite often, they were said to procreate with humans to make demigods or half-gods like Hercules. Paul had unwittingly triggered a collective memory of a story from way back in the misty past. It seems that there was a myth about the Greek gods Zeus and Hermes, or Jupiter and Mercury, if you want to take the Roman version, coming in human form to a town just like Lystra. In the myth, Zeus and Hermes found that they were very unwelcome by the residents, except for an elderly couple who invited the two gods into their home. The couple were rewarded for their kindness because out of anger, the two gods destroyed the town, except, of course, the elderly couple's home. Remember, these people in Lystra are just simple farmers. They're very superstitious as well. Lystra isn't going to make the same mistake as that town in the myth. They didn't want their town destroyed. They loved their town. To the people of Lystra, it was logical that only a god can heal someone, so clearly Paul and Barnabas were gods in disguise. And Paul, because he spoke, they assumed to be Hermes, and Barnabas was therefore Zeus. So quickly, the town rushes up to the two missionaries, not to listen to them preach, but to worship them. At first, it seems that Paul and Barnabas are completely confused by this. As Jewish men, they may not even have heard the story of Zeus and Hermes. It was Luke, who was a Gentile, who had made the connection when recording these events in the book of Acts. The Jews in the other town never acted like this, neither did the Gentiles. Adding to the impulsiveness of the people was the fact that the temple of Zeus was very near their city. When they healed the man, word got back to the temple priest. In haste, the priest and his entourage, they come to where the people had gathered around Paul and Barnabas. They brought bulls and wreaths, and they were gonna sacrifice like crazy to Paul and Barnabas. Finally, understanding the intent of the people, Paul and Barnabas were absolutely horrified. The desire to gain the town's attention had clearly backfired on them. To even suggest such a sacrifice to them was an affront to their faith. both as Jewish men and as Christians. Paul and Barnabas try really hard to reject the offer of a sacrifice and the praise they were receiving. In fact, they do something that was clearly demonstrating their disfavor in this attention. They tore their clothes. And they run into the crowd begging them to stop this idolatry. Now, the tearing of clothes was important because no one in the Middle East would have misinterpreted how upset these two men were. The crowd thought they were gods, but when they tore their clothes, they demonstrated their humanness, that they were just flesh and blood. You can hear the anguish in their words, Paul and Barnabas. Friends, why are you doing this? We're merely human beings like yourselves. Admittedly, it was a bit of a wet blanket they had thrown on the festivities, but it was a necessary thing to do. Paul and Barnabas were just ordinary men with an important message for the people of Lystra. The message, of course, being that they serve the one true God, and the sacrifices and the beliefs of the people of Lystra are absolutely worthless. I'm sure this went over real well. I mean, no one likes to be told that their beliefs are worthless. I mean, look at all the money I put into the temple of Zeus over the years. Wait a minute, someone says. Hold on, maybe it's a test. So the crowd starts up again with renewed vigor. And Paul and Barnabas can't get them to stop their effort to worship them and to sacrifice to them. It's getting out of hand. It's an awful mess. But it gets worse. It seems that Paul and Barnabas were not the only ones who have come from Antioch. Some Jews who hated Christians and particularly hated Paul had followed them to Lystra. Paul, who hunted Christians, is now the one being hunted. How these unnamed Jews did it, we aren't really told, but the Jews whipped the crowd into a murderous mob. The people went from wanting to worship Paul and Barnabas to killing them. In a rage, they dragged Paul out of town and stoned him and left him for dead. And then we read this amazing verse that states that the believers gathered around him. And Paul got up, strangely, and walked back into the city. And the next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. Now, one interesting thing that keeps niggling my brain is, where was Barnabas when Paul was being stoned? What happened to him? I can find no clear answer to that other than he must have been with the other believers who stood around Paul. There is something that I almost missed here. It's very important. In all the flurry of attempted sacrifice and the stoning, some people in the city actually did believe. The believers who stood around Paul had to have come from somewhere. Despite the struggle, despite the opposition, the gospel did take hold in the hearts of the people of Lystra. Not necessarily a big group, but a group nonetheless. And in verse 21, we read that after preaching in Derbe, Paul and Barnabas actually came back to Lystra to strengthen that little church. The one clear lesson that comes out of this passage for me is that the church must always be aware that when it speaks to people, it is all speaking almost always cross-culturally. Now, I need to be clear here to say that when I say cross-cultural in this instance, I'm speaking kind of broadly. If we are believers in Christ Jesus, anyone else who does not yet know Jesus is in a different culture. In our Christian culture, like all cultures, we have a shared history, we have traditions, we have stories, we have language that only Christians use. If you randomly went up to somebody outside the Christian culture and asked them something like, "Are you redeemed by the blood of the Lamb?" They think you're off your rocker. Just think about how many sporting events and family events are now scheduled on a Sunday. and how people react when you say, I'm sorry, I can't come because I'm going to church. How many of your neighbors actually get up on a Sunday morning and go to church? Not many. The world doesn't get it. It is increasingly impossible to say to someone outside of the Christian circles that they must do something because the Bible tells us to. Do you see what I'm trying to tell you? Your neighbors and your coworkers, or even your other family members, are likely just as confused about your faith as the people in Lystra were about Paul and Barnabas. I know personally, I have extended family members who are struggling, even today, to understand my being a minister. It's difficult for them. My dear departed Aunt Ruth used to teasingly say that it must be hard for me to explain my family to my parishioners. On the bigger stage, when one of our fellow Christians or fellow churches does something very unchristlike, we can often get painted with the same brush, right? I know when I hear such stories, I often say a quick prayer, oh Lord, please don't let them be Baptist. When Christians join together to protest a social issue, we're often thought of as out of touch and backward and narrow-minded and bigoted. So first of all, I need to name for you what you've already experienced in your life. Maybe you have experienced it many times, but maybe have never really clearly identified. We, as followers of Jesus, are indeed different from the world. How you and I see the world because Christ dwells in us is fundamentally different than most of the world. For our own sanity and our effectiveness of witness, we need to acknowledge this. We need to embrace this difference. It is who we are. We can do nothing about it. And we should be unapologetic about it too, but that's a topic for another day. The question before us, as it was before Paul and Barnabas, is not how to get the people we are witnessing to think like we do. Because without Christ in their lives, they're not going to. But rather, how do we use our God-given creativity to bridge the gap without causing a riot? How do I reach someone who only knows the name of Jesus as a swear word, or only knows the Bible as those books that Gideons put in hotel rooms? You begin by recognizing what you're up against. Paul and Barnabas were clearly caught off guard. They were blindsided because they were unaware of the depth of the pagan religion in Lystra. In Jesus' words, these were very sick people living in great darkness. Jesus told us he had come to heal the sick, didn't he? And that is what those who of us who have embraced Christ have experienced. We've been healed. Now we live and we serve and we socialize in a brand new reality. But many of our friends, neighbors, and family do not. And Jesus' analogy of illness is a really big help to us. We are never to think of people in the world as us versus them. Instead, we are to see others as people who desperately need what we have, a cure. That was how Paul saw the people in Lystra, and frankly, every place he went. He didn't think less of them for believing in pagan gods. He just knew he had a better life path. Paul ached for them because he himself knew what it was like to know Jesus. So our strategy becomes one of revealing the illness and offering the cure. We must become adept at lovingly asking the questions and promoting the inner soul searching that reveals the emptiness of a life without Jesus. We must always be ready to respond to the crises in people's lives when they don't know what to do with, we know what to do. We know who can help. The challenge is not to get people into a church building. This is important. But rather it's to take the church, that is you and I, to the people. If, as my thesis in this message is, that Christians of this world make up their own cultural group, then I'm encouraging you to flaunt the difference today. If people get to know us and they see that we're different from the world in a good way, they're bound to be attracted to what we have. Chuck Swindoll gives the following example to make the point. Beautiful little observation. He writes, "It is my opinion that the best evangelical center in the greater metropolitan Boston area is not a church. It's a filling station in Arlington. It was owned and operated by a man named Bob, who caught the vision early in his life that his vocation and his calling were welded together. As time passed, his station became known as the place to go for gas and new tires and all kinds of car services. I had seen half a dozen cars lined up bumper to bumper near the two pumps in front of that little gas station, just waiting to be served by that man. He has no banners out front that says Jesus saves, or flags or signs or fish symbols, nothing plastered all over the station or the windows, no sign saying, bring your car to Bob and take your soul to Jesus. He simply did his job. He did it well. And people knew he was in partnership with God. They knew it. He led dozens of people to faith in Jesus Christ just for being the kind of man he was. People may not understand systematic theology, but they do understand fairness. They understand honesty. They understand peace. And they certainly understand love. The world may never say this to us, but frankly, it really does want us to be different.